want to thank everyone for braving the weather today, showing up. I am I'm Dan Woodrow. Just found out I'd be moderating today. I'd like to welcome everyone. Wish everyone a happy secular new year. We want to thank the Harry H. Barron Trust and Rabbi Zev Barron, who's not with us, at least yet today, for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. Torah for Tycoons is celebrating its bar mitzvah year. 13 years we've been gathering. Throughout the past 12 seasons, the COLA has brought the Torah perspectives on business and personal aspects well over 500 people through this program. The next class will be Wednesday, February 1st. Class will focus on conflicts of interest in government and will feature Ben Figa, Assistant City Attorney for the City and County of Denver, previously Deputy Legal Counsel for the Office of Governor John Hickenlooper, and Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, Senior Educator for the Denver Colwell Community. Some very exciting news in the past 24 hours. The Colwell just moved yesterday from its previous location to a new location at 1395 Wolf Street. This will be Colwell's temporary West Denver location until it completes its new building in West Denver. Speaking of which, the Colwell is moving forward in its capital campaign as it is creating infrastructure in multiple locations across Denver. If you would like more information and for dedication opportunities, please speak to a Colwell rabbi following the class. The Colwell's Women Division will hold its annual Women's Wellness Workshop next Wednesday, next Wednesday evening, 6:30 at Cableland. For more info on the event, please contact the Colwell at info@denvercolwell.org. If you've missed past Torah for Tycoon classes, you may listen to recordings. You can find them on the Colwell's website, www.denvercolwell.org. You can also find the latest info on programming and archive classes on many topics on the website. Now I'd like to introduce today's presenters. Arthur Kutzer, Managing Partner at Center Goldfarb & Weiss, LLC, and Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, Senior Educator for the Denver Community Colwell. Art, great. I believe you're on.
Thank you.
On.
So the issue that we're here to discuss today is when is someone liable for an injury to property or person due to the condition of property. In the legal community, we call this premises liability. In Colorado, we have a statute that governs this type of claim, which basically overrules all prior common law. So common law, basically, think about the term negligence, failure to use reasonable care, and what we have is a statute that is in place that is the only method for obtaining remedy for a dangerous condition on the property. It probably makes sense to narrow the scope of what we're talking about so that it's clear. We're talking about dangerous conditions on property, not something that somebody does on their property that causes damage outside their property. So your failure to keep mud on your property that slides off your property into somebody else's property, that would be outside the scope of the premises liability statute. There are other types of claims that are carved out. For example, ski accidents. If you're going after a ski area for liability, there's a separate statute for that. It would not be covered by the premises liability statute. If you're making a claim against a dude ranch because somebody gets injured by a horse, horses also have their own statute in Colorado, the equine liability statute, so that wouldn't be covered. So what we're talking about is dangerous conditions on the property, and the purpose of the statute and the purpose of the common law is to protect landowners from claims. I mean, that's the primary purpose. In effect, if you watch what happens in the courts, you would question whether that really is the purpose of the statute, because nobody seems to recognize that, fall back to that position. Another purpose of the statute is to help ensure that insurance for property owners is affordable. Again, if you see what goes on in the courts, you would question whether anybody's remembering that's the purpose of the statute. Also, I'll note early on here, to the extent you hear me cynical, it's only because I deal with these kind of claims year in, year out, and anybody that thinks they know the answer on these cases just needs to practice in the area, and you'll soon learn it often does not turn on the facts, it often doesn't turn on the law. So it depends on your specific facts. I can tell you, if Walmart is the defendant, the rules are not quite the same. Okay, so premises liability statute is the sole remedy against the landowner for property, for conditions on the property. Colorado has what we call a comparative fault statute, or a modified comparative fault statute, which bars a claim if the injured person is 50% at fault for causing his own injury. So, on a slip and fall case, if you've got a snowstorm and the question is whether the grocery store used reasonable care in shoveling their sidewalks, they could make a claim against them for slipping and falling. But if the woman that fell was wearing spike heels on an icy day, one would argue that she is comparatively at fault by not wearing proper shoes for the conditions, and if the jury finds that she's 50% at fault and the grocery store is 50% at fault, no recovery in Colorado. 50-50, the tie goes to the defendant. What kinds of dangerous conditions are we talking about? Obviously, snow and ice on sidewalks, spilled milk in the grocery store, a sinkhole on somebody's property that could cause somebody to fall in. Certainly, the mountain properties where you have dangerous conditions, a cave or a mine, you can have a lot of claims that way. And if you are a store owner or a restaurant owner and somebody falls inside your place, they trip on the stairs, they trip due to inadequate lighting. Parking lot, we even see claims against parking lot owners, inadequate lighting. The reason that somebody was raped in the parking lot is because the light wasn't bright enough. Usually, that's a questionable type of claim, but we see them. So who is responsible? The statute says that the landowner is responsible. Again, if you don't know the background, the word landowner might sound limiting. But in effect, our courts have said that's a pretty broad term. Landowner is defined as anybody who is responsible for the conditions on the property. So on the slip and fall claim, what you see is they sue the titled owner, which is usually some REIT out of New York City that owns the strip mall. Then Kroger, who owns the King Supers, who is the tenant, and then the snow removal contractor, who wasn't called out because there wasn't enough snow that week, they all get sued. And they all potentially are landowners under the statute because they arguably could be responsible for the conditions on the property. You have remodeling done inside your home, and the contractor takes down the railing on the stairway, and another contractor comes to the house and falls off the stairs. Arguably, the contractor who took down the railing on your stairway would be considered a landowner under the statute and potentially could be sued because they are responsible for the condition that was dangerous, meaning the missing railing. So it's a very broad term, and I guess the only limit on it is the creativity of the lawyers who are filing the claims. There are some limits, and we have some case law on this. So if you're a tenant in the strip mall and the landlord maintains responsibility for and ownership and control of the parking lot, and you rented only the store and nothing outside the store is your responsibility, arguably you should not be sued as a landowner under the statute for someone slipping and falling in the parking lot, because you do not meet the definition of landowner. So there should be some limit on that. So if there's a claim of a dangerous condition on the property and you get the right landowner or landowners, what is the standard or the duty that the property owner owes? Under the statute, it depends on the classification of the person who's injured. There are three categories: trespasser, invitee, and licensee. We could spend all day talking about the definition of those three, and I can assure you, whatever you think the answer is, somebody can come up with an argument to squeeze another angle to it. What I see in practice is that the more sympathetic the person on the site getting injured, the less likely they're going to be designated a trespasser. So,
say that again?
If somebody is sympathetic, say a child, they're less likely to be deemed a trespasser. And the reason is because the landowner owes the trespasser the least amount of care on the property. So let me go a little further and I'll try to explain that. So, trespassers have no consent to be on the property. And for a trespasser to prevail on a claim against the landowner, they have to show the injury or the damage was caused willfully or deliberately. So you really have to meet a high burden to sue if you're a trespasser. The problem is getting a court to determine somebody is a trespasser. I have had cases where the person admits they were not going on the property to transact business with my client. They had no business to be on there. They weren't aware of any invitation. They had no consent to be on the property. And they're walking across the property to cut across rather than going around the property. By most accounts, that's a trespasser. Unless they're severely injured, and then the court scratches their head and says, I can't get myself to call them a trespasser. Not if they have brain injury, not if they have a fractured neck. Again, the cynic in me says it's very hard to get somebody designated a trespasser. And I litigated those cases, and very rarely will that happen. Yes?
So I don't understand. Cutting through a property, I understand you're on somebody's property, but really, how is that trespassing? They're literally just passing through. They don't stop.
You have no,
they don't squeeze. They don't do anything.
You weren't invited on the property,
right.
And you have no business to be there. That is the definition of a trespasser.
Across a corner or something like that.
Right. That I think that's the definition. No consent to be on the property.
But who would you ask to cross the property if you're just crossing the property?
You're right. But the sign says no trespassing.
Well, the sign's different. But I'm saying...
I don't think it is. I think that... Because the case I'm talking about where the person was crossing our parking lot in downtown Denver, it said no trespassing. The person admits they had no... They didn't park their car in our
right.
parking lot.
They're just crossing.
Right. And that is the definition of a trespasser, and yet a judge couldn't get himself to say so. And so he said...
It's so weird.
It is. And the three categories are very difficult to get a black and white definition for that reason.
Okay.
I have a quick question about willful deliberate.
Yes.
Is that only willful deliberate injury to person or also property?
Either. I think it has to be willful or deliberate damage.
So if you put like a spike in a parking lot to keep the cars off, and a trespasser comes on, in that case, the court will...
That's a good question.
You deliberately put it there to with cars if somebody trespasses.
Well, right. So if the condition you put on the property spikes, you are intending to spike somebody's tire that comes on the property.
Right.
I'd say that's willful or deliberate damage.
Even to a trespasser.
Yeah.
You have liability for this.
It's difficult, and I would say anybody who says that's black and white is wrong. It's too hard to do. Let's go to the second category. Licensee. Licensee is there with consent, but they're benefiting as well. The usual example is a door-to-door salesman. So the door-to-door salesman comes on your property, whether your business or your home. They're there for their own benefit, as well as to hopefully benefit you with their service or product. That's an invitee. Invitees, it's a little more difficult to understand the statutory requirement of the duty of care because it's long-winded and uses too many of the same terms. And by the way, the statutes, the way they're drafted, it's often drafted by lawyers, but not lawyers that litigate these things. And so that's the problem I see, is if you had the trial lawyers writing the statutes rather than the guys that tend to do this, you might get a little judicious with the word choice. But a licensee can only recover against the landowner for dangers created by the landowner, which he knew of, or failure to warn of dangers not created by the landowner and not ordinarily on the property. And so it's a higher standard of care for the landowner to protect against injury to a licensee. The third category is an invitee. Invitees have consent to be there. So when you go into a Walmart, you go into a King Soopers, you are invited in. The public is welcome. And so we have the highest standard of care for the invitee, and the standard there is that we must protect against dangers which you knew or should have known of. So that's more of a negligent standard. So when we talk about the spill on the grocery floor, the key issue in that is, did the store know or should they have known? So the critical issue when we get the slip and fall on the broken eggs or the spilled milk, how long was it present? That's really the most important question, because if it just fell and 10 seconds later this person walks by and slips and falls, what is the failure to use reasonable care by the grocery store? There can't be. However, if there's surveillance film and you can see the thing being spilled and 4 hours later somebody falls, then the landowner's got a problem. And so the hardest problem in those kind of grocery store cases is for both the plaintiff proving how long it was there and then from the landowner proving that it couldn't have been there 4 hours because we regularly patrol. So if you look in like a restaurant bathroom, a lot of times they have a little log on the wall where they have their employees put a little notation what time they checked the restroom. Probably because lawyers over the years have told them, we need to prove that we checked it and there was nothing on the floor at 6 o'clock, and that way when the person claims they fell at 6:30, we just checked it 30 minutes ago, and that's not unreasonable to check once an hour. Okay? Yes?
I don't know if this is the appropriate spot in this presentation, but could you talk about this case in Vail where a young man went back up the mountain, and then whether there was an avalanche or something, he wasn't supposed to be in that area. The Vail associates.
If you're talking about a claim against the ski area, that is totally outside the premise liability statute because there's a separate ski statute that protects ski resorts, ski areas, and its purpose, and does a much better job than the premises liability statute does for landowners. The ski statute makes it very difficult to sue the ski area. Basically, you have to show that they knew about a danger, such as a boulder in the path, and didn't properly mark it or didn't do something. But let's just bring it to premises liability. Let's forget about ski area. Just say, if you're a trespasser on my mountain property and you get caught in an avalanche, you shouldn't have been there, and there's no way you're going to prove that I willfully caused your injury, and so I think you're out of luck if you're a trespasser. The difficulty really is between the classifications, because then the duty changes. So let's go to one instance where you can have somebody converted from a trespasser to an invitee, and that's what we call the attractive nuisance doctrine. And what the doctrine is for is if you've got a swimming pool on your property, and it's a private pool, but it's the kind of thing that every kid walking by coming home from school can see the pool, and it attracts the child onto the property, the law has developed this doctrine to say, even though you didn't invite the kids to go swimming, if your swimming pool in your backyard is an attractive nuisance, and therefore, although you didn't give consent for them to be on your property, the law gives them constructive consent, and you are liable as if they were invitees. So that's the net attractive nuisance doctrine. Again, the problem with this is how is it going to be applied by the courts? I just wanted to mention real quickly a case I handled, and then we'll get to Rabbi Fleischer. I handled a case that involved attractive nuisance. It involved a giant inflatable. This is a Wacker case that went to the Colorado Supreme Court.
Oh, that inflatable?
It was an inflatable, like the bouncy castles. So it's a reservoir Memorial Day party. The boat club that's at the reservoir paid to rent this inflatable. Kids are on it. A microburst wind comes up in the afternoon out of nowhere, picks the entire thing, rips it off its moorings, throws it 100 feet down the road, and 50 feet in the air, three kids on it get hurt. And the defense, our defense was that there's no attractive nuisance doctrine issue there because the kids were not attracted to the party. They didn't come on the property because of this inflatable. They didn't even know it was going to be there. What attracted them was the lake party, and it had nothing to do with the inflatable. So how could the inflatable invite them or lure them onto the property? And again, not to be overly cynical, but this is what happens when you go to the Supreme Court of Colorado and you have an 11-year-old with an injury. We change the law. So no longer do you need to be lured onto the property for you to talk about an attractive nuisance. The Wacker case changed that. So I don't know how you can actually write it out as attractive nuisance when you're saying it doesn't have to attract them. But that's what the court did. Bottom line, I would suggest that in Colorado, what judges and juries look at is the total picture, and they tend to ignore the statute and the classifications and the rules that I just went over. And what they say is, you know, does it make sense? Maybe this is where Rabbi Fleischer is going to end up, but does it make sense to compensate somebody even though the black and white rule is here? We're just going to ignore it. The slip and fall in a Walmart, they're more likely to recover. Slip and fall on ice outside a private home, not likely to recover. I don't care what you did. Unless there hasn't been snowfall in 2 weeks and you just never cleaned it up. But other than that, you're pretty safe. So it really depends on who you are. Child versus commercial property owner, not a good scenario. Individual homeowner who shoveled the snow, threw some ice melt down, and somebody still fell, you're in pretty good shape as a defendant, and it's tough for those people to recover.
Can I go back to the bouncy castle for a second?
Okay.
I understand the argument that you made, but it was moored down, and an angel of God, so to speak, picked it up and moved it. I mean, no one was being negligent, no one was not securing it, it's not like they just set it on the ground. Doesn't that have any bearing?
Absolutely. That was the primary argument, but the argument from the injured party was, for heaven's sakes, you didn't have parents surrounding this thing to pull the kids off immediately if any wind came up. No, that we didn't have anybody assigned to that. For heaven's sakes, I had several parents of the other children who were injured that said, I saw no wind, or I would have had my kid off of there. So you're correct, but that, you know, you've got both sides creatively arguing the facts, picking and choosing which facts they want to hold on.
Just what difference does it make that it was if it would be attractive nuisance because they were invitees anyway?
That's a very good question. I argued that it doesn't matter when it's an 11-year-old kid.
You've got to get the judge to learn tomorrow.
You know, maybe Rabbi Fleischer can speak to this, but does the rule change if you feel sympathy for the claimant? I would suggest to you that our appellate courts in Colorado, I've seen it way too many times. It does make a difference.
He's raising the question of when I asked him why he's not an invitee to circumvent the whole attractive movement.
Right, I agree.
Your snow shovel rule. City County never has a rule you have to shovel, besides you don't.
Right.
So isn't that a per se
Well, so the interesting thing about the city of Denver is you're talking about sidewalks owned by the city, and normally you would not be considered. Normally you would not be a landowner under the statute for property you don't own. However, and normally we would say on the premises of liability, you have no exposure. However, they would sue you for violation of municipal requirements that you keep it clean. So it basically is a constructive position as you become the landowner for the sidewalk that you don't own.
So then Denver, if you don't shovel the sidewalk, you would be liable for the property.
Only because of the ordinance, not because of the premises liability.
Don't you actually own the land, but there's an easement of the city there?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Typically, you have a lot that goes all the way to the street, and the city's got an easement for a sidewalk, and you've got the obligation to maintain the easement.
Right. I think that's true.
I look into the streets, so we've been doing a lot of purchasing of properties that have funny sidewalks. Doesn't seem like
well, you're on the west side, so that's
yeah, no, right. He's on the south side.
Oh, south side. Okay. So Rabbi, help us understand from an ethical and halachic standpoint.
This young man had a question.
Is there a time frame? This is just a spoke of follow up with what you were saying. Is there a time frame of if it's not snowing now and I'm at work?
Yeah.
And between the time I between now and when I get home, someone. Is there a time frame where I can say, or even after I get home, I just didn't get around to it tonight. I'm just going to do it.
Right. What's a reasonable time? And we deal with those all the time in strip mall slip and falls. What's a commercially reasonable time to clear the snow? Usually, if it starts snowing at 6 a.m. and somebody falls at 7, that's a real hard case to prosecute because it's not commercially reasonable to expect somebody to get out there with a hairdryer and dry up every flake of snow from the first one that falls. On the other hand, if it snowed 2 or 3 days ago, and you haven't gotten, and you don't have evidence that you did snow removal, that's a problem.
Is there a line in the ordinance or in the law that within 24 hours, or is it just...
No, I don't think there is.
I think that's true. Someone told me that in Colorado also, that after the snow finishes, it's 24 hours. I don't know if...
Well, that's the ordinance. That's not the premises liability statute.
The premises liability.
That may be a guideline.
Yeah.
Okay. So... A lot here to try to deal with. I'll try to deal with as much as we can in the time we have. I do want to just give a preface before I begin, an important preface. That is that in Jewish law, Torah law, halacha, has a very unique viewpoint of damages caused by one's property or assets or possessions. Okay, and I'll get more into this a little bit later. But the basic viewpoint is that there are very specific rules and guidelines set down by the Torah, okay, and expanded at great length by the Talmud and later authorities regarding the liability of one's property and possessions. The classic Talmudic case of the ox goring the cow is not cut and dry that you're always liable. There are a lot of conditions that have to apply. Is the ox known to be a violent ox? Does it have a past history? Or is this the first time it's ever displayed violent behavior? Something like that could be a major modifying factor in what the ruling would be. When we talk about some sort of an obstacle or a pit, classic case of what's known as a bar, a pit on one's property, are you liable if someone falls in there? If they had the right to walk on there, is not that clear that it applies to every case. There are limits, there are very specific guidelines that apply, and although we don't have time to go through all of them, there's an entire tractate in the Talmud devoted to this, known as Bava Kamma, and we'll see about 3 lines from it, maybe a little more, maybe about 6 lines, out of the 118 folios of that tractate. I'm not even getting involved in the bookcases upon bookcases of later commentators and halachic literature written upon it. But we'll try just to get a little bit of a picture, but it's important to keep in mind as we go through our discussion here that it's not just the knee-jerk reaction of, well, it's your property,
it caused damage, perhaps you could have done more and therefore you are liable. There are very specific guidelines that the Torah lays down as to when one is liable for monetary damages. Okay? Having said that, before I even get into that, I want to start with a different question. That is, before the damage occurs, is there or what is the ethical responsibility of an individual to take the proper safety precautions that people not get injured? Is there an ethical mandate? Is there an obligation according to Torah law? So I'm sure some of you are familiar with the idea in source number one. I here quoted the words of the Rambam, Maimonides, who says it is a positive commandment for a person to erect a fence around his roof, as the verse states, and you shall make a fence for your roof. Whether a roof or anything that poses a danger that a person can stumble upon and die. So here Maimonides qualifies, and he says, it's not limited to a roof. And by the way, a roof means a roof that is frequented by people. If you have your standard classic home with a sloped roof, where the only person going up there is the guy installing the antenna, or the roofer, and not really, or the chimney sweep, but not really anyone else, so then you don't really have to put up a roof. That would probably look a little bit odd to have a fence around one of those sloped roofs. You don't have an obligation. But if you're talking about a roof which is flat and people go up, let's say an apartment building or something like that, there's an obligation in Torah to put a fence around it so that no one fall and get injured. And Maimonides says that extends to anything that poses a danger that a person can stumble upon and die, such as one who has a spring of water or a pit in one's courtyard, and so to any obstacle that poses a danger to life, says Maimonides, it is a positive commandment to remove it and guard against it and be very, very careful in the matter. Okay, and he goes to, the Rambam, Maimonides in his works, is not prone to expressing excessive verbiage without good reason. Okay, he's very succinct, terse to the point. And here he says a whole bunch of words. He says, one has to remove it, guard against it, and be, he says, very, very careful in this matter. And so the Rambam is trying to hammer home this point that it's a big deal. In Jewish law, taking care of one's life and one's health and safety is a big deal. Now, there's a lot of discussion exactly where how far this obligation goes. And again, I don't have time to go into all the details today. Is it only a potential danger to life? What if it's a danger to limb? Is that included in the obligation, or would that just be in the spirit of the law, not necessarily the letter of the law? What if it's, how do you define a danger? There is discussion about, let's say, a swimming pool. Would one be obligated to put up a fence around the swimming pool, or because people know that there's a swimming pool here, and when you are around the swimming pool, there are steps you go in and ladders, and people are generally cautious around the swimming pool, and they see there are normal entrance ways, so perhaps one does not have to put up a fence around it, again, within the obligation. Maybe the spirit of the law is it's a good idea to have a fence around it. Exactly how far that goes is a lot of discussion. Okay, but the basic idea that one needs to take precautions to prevent damage to the person of oneself or others is actually a mitzvah, an obligation in the Torah. A roof may not be that common for the average homeowner, but a porch, which has some significant height above the ground, one would likely be obligated to put a fence around that porch so that one not fall from it and injure or worse, incur bodily harm. So that idea certainly would apply in a general sense to these kinds of things, and one could therefore argue that perhaps falling under that obligation, certainly under the spirit of the law, if there's a significant snowfall and it's going to get icy and slippery, one ought to be taking the proper steps to remove the snow from one's property and to make sure that does not pose a hazard if that's on your property and things like that. Okay? And does that mean that my time is up? Oh. 2-minute warning? That's it. I'm done. That's it. Okay. Source 2 extends this idea not just to property hazards that are stationary, but even to bringing other things into your property that are dangerous. If you look at source number 2, Rabbi Nelson said, from where do we know that one may not raise a bad dog? That term bad dog, besides bad dog, but the idea of bad dog, how you define a bad dog, is the subject of a great deal of discussion. Again, we don't have sufficient time to go through it,
but a bad dog in one's house, nor erect a shaky ladder in one's house. The verse states, you shall not place blood in your house. Okay, and that's an obligation, again, in the Torah, to avoid putting things that could pose harm to yourself or others within your house. A shaky ladder, an animal which can pose a danger. You know, I'm not getting involved in an argument over here about whether pit bulls are safer or not, those kinds of pets and so on and so forth. Perhaps one can make an argument that they are dangerous and therefore either need to be severely restrained or perhaps not be owned at all. Certainly, having animals like raising tigers on your property or things like that are probably best avoided according to this interpretation. That actually gets involved in a separate discussion. Really, the premise of this class and what inspired this class, if you saw the flyer, was the tragic events that happened this past summer at Disneyland, where an alligator came out of the water and killed a child. I'm sorry, didn't come out of the water. The child went into the water, and the alligator tragically killed the child. Over there, and as we'll try to talk about a little bit more, Disney did not put the alligators on the property. They probably would have been a lot happier if the alligators would not have been on the property. So it probably wouldn't fall under this heading, under this category of you shall not place it in your house. But one could make the argument that it falls under the first category of you have to make sure there aren't hazards on your property that could pose danger. Okay, and once you see that that's not just limited to a hole in the ground or a swimming pool where a child could fall in, but even to an animal, that an animal poses a danger, so one can make the argument that if they were aware, and just based on the stories I saw, it seemed like there was some degree of awareness that there were alligators in the area, it would seem like they perhaps should have taken, again, I don't know the details, and reading stories in the media is always a tricky business of what really went on and so on. But just based on what I read, it would seem like perhaps that they could have taken further precaution in terms of letting people know that there are active dangers, not just don't go wading in the water. Okay? But that is as far as the ethical obligation in the first place. Now, that brings us, for the rest of our sources, to practically speaking, after the fact, what are the obligations? What is the liability? So first off, we have the very first Mishnah in Tractate Bava Kamma that says there are four fathers. Okay, I use that term fathers. That's the term used in the Mishnah. The term father means overarching categories, primary categories of damages. And that is the ox, the pit, mave, I left that untranslated for a reason, and fire. Okay, mave, there's some debate in the Talmud what that means, if it's referring to another kind of damage done by an animal, or if it's referring to that greatest of all damagers, the human. Okay, I remember when I was in high school reading a story called The Most Dangerous Game. Anyone familiar? Short story? Rabbi Heyman is from my generation. Anyways, the premise of the story is that the most dangerous game is hunting humans. And so the human is, according to some opinions, included in those four categories. We're not talking about humans today. We're talking about the other three. Ox, pit, and fire. And the Talmud discusses the parameters of each one and what each one's parameters are, what makes it unique, which other areas fall under those categories, and so on and so forth. So just as an example, the Talmud says an ox is an entity which moves under its own power and has the potential to go and cause damage, various kinds of damage. A pit is a stationary kind of damage where the person, where the damagee would have to walk into it, okay, and whose primary function exists merely is a damager. An ox does not exist primarily to cause damage. It does other things. It plows, it gives you rides, it pulls, it provides this wonderful lunch and learn, and so on and so forth, so it has other functions. But it also causes damage. A fire requires other forces for it to cause damage. It needs wind for it to spread. And so each category needs to be dealt with and see if it falls under those categories. The Talmud talks about having combinations of categories and having various potential scenarios fall under combinations of categories. And again, very lengthy discussion, but what's important for our discussion is source number four. And that's the case of the pit. The Talmud says that if an ox and its implements fell into a pit and they broke, meaning the animal was damaged and the implements were damaged or they broke, and a donkey and its implements fell in and they tore, he is liable for the animal and exempt for the tools. Why? He's liable for the damage caused to the animal, exempt for the tools. Why? And another case, a young boy or a young girl, or a slave or a maidservant, in other words, a person, fell in, the owner of the pit is exempt for the person or for the tools. Why? Says the Talmud, based on the oral law and its interpretation of the verse, a pit is not liable for vessels if they break, or for humans who are killed inside a pit. A human who is damaged, there is liability. A human who is killed, there is no liability for a pit. And a vessel which breaks is liable as well. And there's a great deal of discussion about this, and it's not, again, not, we don't have time to go into all the details, but this was my preface, that it's not just, well, it's your pit, you're liable. The Torah says, no, this is your property. And liability for property doesn't keep the same rules as if you cause damage, and the liability differs, and there are different rules and conditions. And so consequently, it's not cut and dry that every time an impediment, a bar, an obstacle, or something of that sort that causes damage would necessarily incur liability because of the damage that it caused to a person walking into it. Okay, and it's, again, just important to keep that in mind, that therefore if you were to go with a case like this to a Beis Din, a Jewish court of law, the first thing the Jewish court of law would look at is what are the parameters of obligations of liability for a bar, for a pit, for a fire, for anything that falls under the category of fire, or under ox, or under a pit.
So there isn't the concept of premises liability. It's divided into some categories instead. There's no
right.
Category.
Correct. Although, more about premises liability in a second, because it differs whether it takes place in the public domain or in a private domain. So we'll look at that in a minute. But yeah, you are correct.
It's all not attractive.
Huh? It's attractive. What?
It's all not attractive.
There is... About, well, that's ownership of property, really, more, and rights of property owners. Okay, that's right of way and rights of trespassing, and you know, you talk about having rights of easement and things like that. Yeah, those are the rights of the property owner, not my obligations of liability as a property owner. But yeah, that is true. Okay, so that's just kind of an overview, a very brief overview of that. Liability when it comes to an obstacle, impediment, anything like that, is much more limited in Jewish law than it would be necessarily in secular law that we have here in America. I do want to point out also that the idea of dina de malchus adina, the law of the land is law, plays a significant role in these kinds of cases, practically speaking. I'm trying to present over here if we were to be living in an area where the Jewish law was the law of the land, and we're not dealing with a secular law system, this is what you would deal with. Practically in America today, if a lawsuit were to be brought, there would be complications based on the law of the land as law, and what are the assumptions, and where does that hold sway over the halacha, and where doesn't it? That's a whole different discussion. Now, here is where life gets interesting, because Dan mentioned the idea of premises, and the liability on the premises, so that brings us to source number 5. The classic case that people talk about when they talk about a bar, a pit, that category is stated right at the beginning of source number 5, when one digs a pit in a public domain. Okay, so let's say, if you are, as mentioned at the outset of the class, in West Denver, really all over Denver, there's a huge amount of construction going on, and I get a hold of one of those jackhammers, I've always wanted to try one, and I go out in the middle of Spirit Boulevard, and I drill myself a hole right in the middle over there, and within about 30 seconds, a car falls in, loses its tire, hubcap and all, and that's the classic case. That is a classic case of a pit, where, again, you would get involved in all the details and so on and so forth. But what if I dug the pit in my own domain, in my own backyard? What's my liability? So the source, the passage continues. If one digs in his own domain, but places its opening by the public domain, so again, it's open to the public, and therefore the public could be damaged, or places the opening by his friend's domain, I create a pit, a tunnel of some sort, and the opening opens up right into my neighbor's property, very nice of me, or he dug and placed this opening in his domain, I dug a pit in my backyard, but I rendered the property hefker. Hefker means, generally translated as ownerless in Jewish law, but I did not render the pit hefker, ownerless, you're liable for the damages. That's a little bit of a bend over backwards kind of case. I dig a pit in my backyard. I render the property around it ownerless, but not the pit ownerless. I am liable. Seems like a rather impractical, unlikely case. But I'll give you a very practical case where this applies. I said hefka means ownerless, but it doesn't have to be limited to that. Let's say I dig a hole in my backyard, or I'm doing some construction, and there's a big pile of debris and dirt and whatever in my backyard, and then I invite my son's friend to come over and play in the backyard. Okay? In a sense, I have rendered it ownerless, if you will, to that individual. I have given him permission to access my property, okay, which you call the invitee. So hefker is a general term here which kind of indicates that I am allowing people onto my property, and I may not have given them access to the hole. Okay? But I tell the kids, stay away from that pile of dirt in the backyard, which is a big sign that says, go, 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 if you've ever had that experience. And what you say is, everyone go play over there, and then you're assured that they will go play somewhere else. That's how to do it properly. But they and the child comes on, he climbs up the hill, falls down, hurts himself. So then you would have a situation where there would be liability. Because yes, it's on my domain, it's on my property, but I gave permission for this individual to be there, and therefore there would be liability for such a case. That's a case of an invitee. That's a case of an invitee. Trespasser, so far it would seem like, based on this source alone, that there's no real source for liability for a trespasser at all. At all. Attractive nuisance or otherwise, because you have no business being on my property. The case the Talmud talks about where there's liability is where the pit belonged to me. Either it belonged to me, or I dug it in the public domain, and people had a business being there, and they fell in, they were injured, then there's liability for the owner of the pit. But if it's on my property, and the individual who was damaged has no business being there, then it would seem like there's no liability whatsoever, even if it looks very exciting to climb up that big pile of dirt and rubble. He had no business being there. Attract nuisance would seemingly not play a factor. Okay? Source number 6 is really an addendum to source number 5, which says that if the pit was dug on its own, I have a backyard, and a pit develops on its own, or one of my kids made it, or whatever the case may be, or an animal dug it, some sort of animal dug it, okay, the owner would still have liability, again, in a situation where people have business being there. Even if the owner didn't dig the pit himself, he would be liable because it's on his property. He's obligated to fill it in or cover it, and he did not do so. He is liable for the damages. Now, Art mentioned situations, let's just say, where I own a King Superstore, okay, and a customer, we'll get to the case of the customer shortly. Let me wait on that for source number 7. But let's say a bottle of milk falls off the shelf on its own, okay, somehow. And the bottle of milk fell off and created a mess on the floor. So I didn't create this bar, this pit, this obstacle, this danger. It's not my fault. The answer is, it is your fault. It's your property, and therefore you bear liability for what took place. You have a responsibility. You're right. If the milk would have picked itself up, walked outside, and spilled all over Colfax Avenue in West Denver, okay, or on Spear Boulevard over here, and someone would have slipped, it's not on my property. It's not necessarily my problem. But if it happened on my property, I have an obligation as a property owner. I am the owner of this property, and by extension, all of the obstacles, impediments, dangers that are present on this property, I am responsible for as well, and I would be responsible. How long you have to know about it is the subject of a great deal of discussion in the Talmud. Again, not within the time frame over here. I'm already running out of time. But there's a lot of discussion how long you have for awareness. Once you become aware, how long do you have to cover it up? The Talmud has varying opinions on that as well. There's a lot of discussion about that, how long you have to become aware, and once you're aware, how long you have to cover it up, different kinds of coverings, and so on and so forth. That's a lot of much broader discussion. But just the basic idea that if it's on your property, you're responsible. Now, what if a customer knocked a bottle of milk down? So you could argue, well, Rabbi, it's not your problem, it's the customer's problem. The customer created this puddle on the floor, and the customer ought to be liable. Not so fast. Source number 7. And so too, if another person dug a pit in another property owner's domain, and it became known to the property owner is obligated to cover the pit. And if he did not cover it, it's like he himself dug it, and one who digs a pit is liable to pay for the damages caused by his property. So here we have again the idea that it's your property and it's your problem. He's the one who dug it. He's the one who knocked the bottle of milk over. He's the one who dropped that can of marinara sauce or whatever it is happened over there. It doesn't matter. He is obligated to pay you for the damage caused by dropping the can of marinara sauce. So if I have to go call in a cleanup crew to clean up the milk, and that costs me $5, let's just say, of their time and effort and expense to clean it up, he'll have to pay me for those $5, because that's, in a sense, he caused me damage.
But he's off the hook.
Huh? He's off the hook. Once I'm aware. Now, here's where life gets interesting. Here's where life gets interesting. Let's say you have a customer. I had this experience a few weeks ago. I think, Rabbi Schwab, you walked by about 2 minutes after this happened. I was trying to get a 12-pack of soda down from one of those huge stacks in King Supers, and one of them toppled down and fell down, and one of the cans exploded and was spraying all over the place. Okay? Thankfully, it was early in the morning. There weren't too many people there. What?
And there were no kids to blame either.
There were no kids to blame either. That's right. It was just me. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning. And now there's a puddle on the floor. So I immediately pushed everything to the side, and I told the first representative, person in the store, I'm very sorry, this is what happened, it fell down, and I let them know, okay? Within the reasonable, before he's aware, because if you look at the wording over here of source number 7, it's, if the property owner, it became known to the property owner. It became known. He has to know about it, okay? What if he didn't know about it? What if some guy walked onto my property, dug a hole, and ran away? I don't know about it. And then I have people coming over visiting, and this fellow dug the hole and ran off. So then there's a lot of discussion who's liable. There's a lot more room than to say that the guy who dug the hole is liable. Until I become aware of it as a property owner, that until that point the onus of remains on the shoulders of the person who created it. Once the property owner is aware of it, then the property owner becomes liable. And then the person who created the impediment, the obstacle, just has to reimburse me for my costs of fixing up, filling in the hole, cleaning up the milk, whatever the case may be. Okay? So that would be a difference. And this is where, Art mentioned, you have to have different people who are regarded as property owners when you have a hazard. This is where life could get complicated and interesting, depending on which side, I guess, you're on, if it's interesting or complicated. But this is where life gets complicated. One person is bringing his jumping castle onto the property, and he's operating it. He's an independent third party operating the jumping castle on my property, let's just say. Who would be liable, if anybody? Let's just assume that jumping castle is indeed a bar, a pit, and presents a danger. Let's just assume that for the moment. Who would be liable for the damage caused by it? Would the owner of the jumping castle? It belongs to him. He created it. But the property owner was aware that it was there and didn't take the necessary precautions to avoid damage. Discussions like this could get rather complicated in terms of determining, ultimately, who is responsible, who takes the responsibility for these kinds of things happening. That's where it could get complicated in a Jewish court of law as well. And I imagine it could probably be presented with numerous different angles. In a general sense, in terms of who's the property owner, the owner sitting thousands of miles away in his high-rise real estate office, in his skyscraper real estate office, sorry for the wrong term, somewhere in downtown Manhattan, or the poor franchisee who's trying to eke out a living on this property over here. Generally, the one who is renting the property and who is operating on it, he is the first address. He's generally the one who's responsible, unless specified otherwise. But generally, the one who's renting it and using the property actively is the first address for responsibility. Okay? That's, in a sense, where the responsibility lies. Again, it's not simple, a lot of detail, but just some of the ideas that come up. Now, if you will go to source number 8 and 9, I'd like to show you a fascinating discussion in the Talmud. It's a little bit in-depth, so put on your thinking caps, but I think it's worthwhile. You'll see, when I met with Art before this class, I said, I can't imagine I'll find very much about attractive nuisance in the Talmud. And I spoke to an expert on Jewish monetary law in Lakewood, New Jersey, and he said, look at this source. So let me share this very interesting source with you. And he felt that it could arguably be applied to the attractive nuisance case. Here's the deal. Source number 8. One brought his produce into the courtyard of a property owner without permission. Okay? So Mr. A brought his big pile of wheat onto Mr. B's property and dumped it down over there without permission. Mr. B's animal was damaged by the produce. That animal walks around in the yard over there, and Mr. B's animal was damaged. The owner of the produce is liable to pay for the damages. I had no business bringing my produce in there. Your animal went ahead, you the property owner's animal, Mr. B's animal, went ahead and was damaged by the produce. Mr. A is the one who created the obstacle, the impediment, and he is liable. Says Rav, the great Talmudic sage, we have only learned that he is liable if the animal slipped on the produce. But if it ate it, the produce owner is exempt. Why? It should not have eaten the produce. Who asked the animal to eat it? So the fact, if it's just walking around doing its thing and it slips, then you're liable because the animals walk around in yards. But the animal, it should not have eaten the produce. That is the argument. Now, it's not saying the animals don't tend to eat produce lying around. If you leave the weed in the yard, it's going to eat it. But the argument is that the animal went ahead, proactively brought the damage upon itself. As opposed to just walking around where it slipped, that's something it does. The argument is that eating it is where it took it a step further. It didn't just walk around, but it went ahead and ate it. It proactively engaged in this produce, and therefore the animal is regarded as having had a role in bringing the damage upon itself, and therefore the owner of the produce would be exempt. That is Rav's argument. Said Rav Sheshes, look at the sharp term, he says, Rav must have been sleeping when he said this. You will find this kind of terminology throughout the Talmud. There's a great deal of discussion. There are actually different terms used at different places, and they mean different things, again, beyond the scope of our discussion right now. But Rav Sheshes feels that Rav is making a mistake over here, and he says, I have a brisa, a earlier teaching of a from an earlier source, and therefore, because it's a much earlier source of the Mishnah, not of the Talmud, it would trump the opinion of the Talmudic sage, that says, one who places poison in front of his friend's animal is exempt by human law, but liable by heavenly law. There are certain cases the Talmud talks about where you did not do something sufficient to incur liability in a human court, but up in heaven, they're not too happy with your actions, and if you want to have, you know, your slate clean, you'd better make restitution, because otherwise there's going to be a black mark next to your name up in heaven. It's not a good thing that you did. You bear sufficient responsibility that up in heaven they feel you should pay back, but it's not sufficient responsibility for a human court to find you liable. Placing poison in front of another person's animal is sufficient to find you liable up in heaven, but not down here on earth. Now, says the Talmud, poison is not normally eaten. Produce is normally eaten. So they want to make the following inference. The reason why you're exempt by human law is because it's poison. If you put a container of cyanide in front of a cow, the cow doesn't normally eat cyanide. And therefore, you would be exempt by human law because you don't bear the full responsibility. It's unusual for cows to eat cyanide. But when you put produce, or let's just take it a step further, as a Talmud will in a minute, you put produce laced with cyanide in front of the cow. Cows eat produce whether it's laced with cyanide or not. Okay, you would be liable, even by human law, because there you bear a greater degree of responsibility when you put produce down in front of the animal. That's what you might call an attractive nuisance. Yes, the cow's attracted to produce, and it ate it. That is the argument of Rav Sheshes. Why wouldn't, but according to you, Rav, why wouldn't we say it should not have eaten? That is Rav Sheshes' challenge to Rav's position. And the Talmud gives two answers. I only quoted the second one, that if you want to say the case we're dealing with in this brisa and this teaching is a some sort of a grass called afrasta. And cows eat this kind of grass called afrasta, but afrasta is poisonous. It's a poisonous plant, and therefore it is actually a case where one could make the argument it shouldn't have eaten it, even though it's normal food. So Rav's rebuttal to this challenge is, it's normal food, it's this grass, and nonetheless he's exempt by human law and only liable by heavenly standards. Okay? What does that mean for us? This is a classic case, if you will, of an attractive nuisance. You have a cow. The cow doesn't have the greatest deal of judgment on its side in terms of saying, this is not my produce, I shouldn't eat it. Okay? And if it goes ahead and eats it, the Talmud says, Rav says, you are liable only by heavenly law, but not by human law. So you bear some degree of responsibility, but not full responsibility. And the Talmud wants to advance an argument, says Rav, that you would be exempt by human law. And this individual whom I spoke to, this expert, he said one can make a case that the same would apply to a child. A child does not have the greatest judgment either. Now I shouldn't go into that person's property and jump in a swimming pool or go on that slide or climb up that pile of dirt. But it's a kid, and the kid sees a pile of dirt. There's a big sign that says, climb me. And so one could argue that that attractive nuisance idea parallels the discussion over here, and therefore there would be some degree of responsibility on the property owner, but not full responsibility. Okay? And just in source number 10, I mentioned there are sources that say it would apply even if one mixed poison into it. Okay, so that would be the attractive nuisance. Now, just last but not least, as the clock expires, the question that Art put forth of the Walmart versus the poor six-year-old case. Okay? And the fact does Jewish law recognize that? So there's a teaching in the Torah that says, you shall do what is straight and good. Okay, Vasisa Yosher V'atov, you shall do what is straight and good. And the Talmud invokes this in certain places as either a moral obligation or perhaps even a legal obligation to go beyond the letter of the law. And I wanted to share with you one case the Talmud talks about. The Talmud relates the following case of a Talmudic sage who hired some porters to carry barrels of wine for him from point A to point B. And the porters were not sufficiently careful. As they carried it, they dropped one of the barrels and it shattered. And this Talmudic sage wanted them to pay him for the damage. They were negligent in their work, and he wanted to find them liable. So he went to the local Beis Din, the local Jewish court of law, and the presiding judge, the main judge over there, told him, I don't think you cannot make them pay. He said, why not? They broke my barrel. They were negligent. He said, no, these porters, they work hard all day. They don't really have very much money. This falls on the category of you shall do what is straight and good. Don't charge them for it. Don't charge them for the damage. Okay? The Talmud continues. I'm not done yet. The Talmud continues and says, the porters turned to the judge and said, you know, we don't have any money. We worked hard all day. We're going to go home empty-handed. So the judge turned to the claimant and he said, pay them their wages. He said, pay them their wages. They broke my barrel. I can't charge them. And I pay them their wages? He said, yeah, you shall do what is straight and good. Where this applies is very tricky. You can just hang this up in the courtroom and everything, and just apply it everywhere. But one can make the argument that Walmart versus the six-year-old may fall under this rubric to some degree. Okay, where it applies, how it applies, not so simple. It's a case-by-case basis. Obviously, it cannot be applied liberally. But the idea of, as you say, I feel bad, does seem to exist to some degree in Jewish law as well. Okay.
Thank you, everyone. If there's a quick question, or somebody wants to take the cow's point of view. Sandy?
If they are, through this law, there's a concept of foreseeability coming here. For instance, when I'm thinking of somebody has an allergy, and, you know, it's not a common label like mold or something, but it could be, you know, something like perhaps you're allergic to the, well, it might even just be the odor of fish or something like that that's in a place. It's not anticipated, it's just a
landowner, the liable, or the store owner. That's a good question. The closest I can think of that kind of fact pattern is the newest thing that we're seeing at my kids' schools. If you bring peanut butter, you better not plan on eating with anybody else, because it used to be the kid with the allergy had to go in the teacher's classroom. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, now the kid with the peanut butter has to go somewhere else. And so I can imagine that could be a problem. The schools would certainly recognize that. You know, they don't. It's not so much that you're going to hand the peanut butter sandwich to the kid with the allergy, but you're going to get it on the table, and there's going to be a dangerous condition, and that would be a problem.
Last question.
Yeah. I've seen over the years in the United States is the more and more laws and lawsuits not making people who are liable for their own actions. Okay? So when I look at number of source 4, and I can't remember, source 2, no, I'm sorry, source 4, it says that, you know, a young girl or boy is exempt, the person's exempt.
The owner of the pit will be exempt.
The owner is exempt, and I think I recall it's because it says that a person should be able to see the pit and not fall into it. So we're talking about cows and everything, but where does the hold generally related to a person's hold?
Right. That may be some of the underlying logic behind the law. In other words, the Torah lays down the laws, and then there's a lot of discussion about, well, why does the Torah do it that way? The Talmud even talks about a cow that should have been watching where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an open hole, you can expect your average cow to walk around it. The Talmud says, perhaps, and the Talmud ends up talking about cases where it's at night, or it's a blind cow, or kinds of cases like that, where the cow couldn't have been expected. And again, you have the interesting cases in the Talmud that end up being unlikely, but have practical relevance to practical cases. So there is talk about that, but again, it's a very broad discussion. Exactly when there's an expectation to watch where you're going, and so on and so forth.
But in general, the Torah says that a person has to be responsible.
If the person falls in and is injured, then there is liability. If the person is killed, then there's no liability. That's the difference. That's the law laid down by the Torah. The whys are a separate discussion.
Does that come back from source number one? Because as I recall, the verbiage is that the fallen will fall.
Yeah, that's
meaning that the fallen is already destined to fall.
That's
or am I opening
it? Yeah, you are. You're opening a whole different discussion over there. Yeah.
All right. Next class, February 1st, conflicts of interest in government, relevant topic.
And promises to continue to be relevant. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's what we should get. And we